This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks to everybody for being here with us today. You know, it's one of those nice, it doesn't feel like a February Sunday. It feels kind of one of those late March, early April Sundays. 91.9 Crozet and the Valley's 101.1. Our guests today, Rob Campbell and Pat Calvert, both from the James River Association. Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning, Rick.
Yeah, you know, I just don't like that sound.
Sorry.
Well, you know, it's not the sound. Let me rephrase that. I don't like that volume.
There you go. That's better.
Is that better?
It works for me. Does it work?
Yeah,
for
there
you?
We go. Right. Sometimes I just don't, it's not the right word. I don't like people saying good morning to me. I don't like that sound. How cranky am I? Get off my lawn. But good morning again, Rob Campbell and Pat Calvert from the James River Association. We're going to be talking about toxic materials, how they're transported, how they're stored. Sort of the have we changed and modernized what we need to do in terms of storage and transportation? Because these gentlemen, and I talked with Pat, Rob, I don't know if you were there. Pat was telling me that the incident that happened almost a year ago down in Lynchburg was just a block or two from his office, where the train crashed right off the tracks down in Lynchburg. Explosions, fires right in downtown Lynchburg, oil spilling into the James River, all that. Were both of you there to witness that?
We were. Actually, we were there less than an hour after it happened. I was there less than 30 minutes after it happened. We were both at other points in the watershed working, but we were there very quickly, and it was just absolutely astonishing. And you're right, it was less than a couple blocks away from our office. Actually, it was several hundred feet away from our office, and as well as the other people we share the office with and the restaurant below. So it was quite a scary circumstance.
We'll talk about that in a little more detail later on in the hour, but there's some need to bring to modernize what we're having, at least in my opinion, in the opinion of the James River Association and Bob. And so I guess the goal today is to talk about this and some other incidents that have happened, at least in North America, because there's one in Canada that we'll bring up, as well as locally in the state and West Virginia and elsewhere around the United States. But let's, you know, I've already said my piece about it, at least in just a minor way. Are our methods out of date for the transportation of toxic materials?
In short, yes. At length, yes, definitely. So we're still operating under some, or just a clear lack of regulation of the storage of chemicals, for one. So take you back a little bit. January of last year, Charleston, West Virginia, just to the west of us on the Elk River, had 10,000 gallons of a chemical that most people still don't know what the heck it is, but MCHM, it's used in the coal cleaning process to cleanse the coal before it goes to be burnt, spilled into the Elk River. And all people knew was, it smells like black licorice. Shut down 9 counties, 300,000 people lost their drinking water for days. Two legislators, because General Assembly in West Virginia was in session, two legislators actually had to be hospitalized. So as you can imagine, legislation passed pretty quickly on that to ensure that that doesn't happen. We have over 80% of the toxins that are registered for storage in Virginia sitting within the James River watershed, over 80% of them, 81%. And that made us aware keenly after that January 9th spill that we might need to look at this. And while we were looking at that, February 2nd came along, and I know you've covered this in the past, Rick, but just south of us on the Dan River, 24 million gallons of wastewater and 39,000 tons of toxic coal ash spilled right into the Dan River. And we started thinking, amidst all the Elk River issues, well, maybe we should look at coal ash. I know that we've got some coal ash landfills, basically. They're not really landfills. They're just big ponds filled with this stuff along the banks of our James River. Found out we've got actually 5 billion gallons of it along the water. And then, while we're sort of looking at that issue, April 30th rolled around, and I was actually right here where your studios are in Charlottesville because it had been raining for days, doing an interview with a NBC 29 and about all the rain and how high the water was in the river, in the Ravana, when I started getting, my phone was just buzzing in my pocket, and I thought, what is going on? So I looked at it, and a canoe outfitter right across the river from the explosion site said, you need to get down here, river's on fire. So I basically jumped in my car and booked down to find that at the time, everybody was sort of running around, panicked, not knowing what just happened or what was in the river, but the river was clearly on fire of the likes of something.
Right, that was not a metaphor.
No, it was clearly on fire. Witnesses said that it sounded like a deep fryer because the river was boiling.
You know, as I do, again, we are talking about toxic materials and storage and transportation. Our guest today, two gentlemen from the James River Association, that was Pat Calvert. He's the Upper James River Keeper. We also have Rob Campbell, the Upper James Outreach. If only these sort of organizations paid that much. Rob Campbell, the Upper James Outreach Coordinator. You can go online, by the way, riveratrisk.org. We'll be talking about a program throughout the hour. Doing my homework, I found that a lot of these rules and regulations go back to 1975, and many of them haven't been updated since then. Is that accurate?
Regarding rail in particular, rail storage?
Well, I found the Hazardous Materials Transportation Act.
Right, yeah. Yeah, a lot of these are really old. There were in the 70s, if you go back, you can actually find some old stuff on the internet about this. There were a slew of train derailments and with chemicals that were coming off the rails and with chlorine gas, anhydrous ammonia, various other petroleums and oil being carried on the rails, it sort of alarmed a lot of folks, and probably rightfully so. So some laws came into place. We've been, you know, these rails all along the James River, and we're talking about most of the James River. It's 340 miles long, and everywhere from the very beginning of the James, even farther upstream in Clifton Forge, all the way down to Yorktown, we've got millions of gallons every month, 2 to 6 million gallons from what we've been told, that are traveling right on the banks, right across and along the James River for most of its length. So they're carrying this highly volatile Bakken crude oil from North Dakota, which is, you know, not really precedented carrying this stuff.
And what's the difference?
Yeah.
I mean, people talk about crude oil, and then you hear the phrase Bakken crude oil, and I believe that's capital B-A-K-K-E-N.
That's
correct?
It. Correct? Yeah.
For those who want to break out your Google and look into that.
Right. So when you think of crude oil, oftentimes people envision what leaked into the Gulf of Mexico with the BP Deepwater Horizon spill. And this stuff is not like that. This is a light crude, not a heavy crude. So it tends to float, and it is highly toxic. Contains several carcinogens, and it's not something you want to get on you or even drink, that's for certain. You don't want it in your drinking water source. And it's extremely ignitable and volatile. The oil gas industry sort of resented that soon after this spill. And then according to U.S. Department of Transportation, they said that this particular crude oil has, quote, a higher gas content, higher vapor pressure, lower flash point and boiling point, and thus a higher degree of volatility than most other crudes in the U.S., which correlates to increased ignitability and flammability, unquote, which point the industry sort of backed up, said, whoa, 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 okay, maybe we were wrong on that. So this stuff is more akin to gasoline.
But isn't that, well, I guess my question is, isn't that better because it stays on top of the water and you can burn it off and be done with it?
Well, and in the case in April 30th, Lynchburg spill, there were 105 tankers carrying this stuff, 30,000 gallons, give or take, in each of those cars. So several million gallons of this stuff. One car was punctured. Three of them fell into the river. Only one of them was punctured and leaked nearly its entire contents. And that massive fire was from one car. So we were very fortunate in that, A, it didn't roll towards the restaurant and our office building, which was filled with people at that time of day, and into the river. The river was high and flowing really quickly. It did float, and it did catch fire, which is not always the case. It may not have caught fire, or it could have at any point down the line and created a massive issue. We're very, very fortunate that no one died, but it allowed us the opportunity to look at this as are we taking undue risks here? Or are these risks managed? Or why are we carrying this highly volatile stuff in tankers that are from the 70s or 80s that are designed to carry soybean oil?
And is that so? Again, we are talking about toxic materials and their storage and transportation with Pat Calvert and Rob Campbell from the James River Association. So you're saying that the train device, the train tube, what's the word that I want?
We call that the tanker.
The tanker being used was designed in the 1970s?
Most of them on the rails now are antiquated. They have pretty black paint all over them now, but they make them look that way. They go through, slap a coat of paint on, and, you know, it looks brand new. But honestly,
so they're painted fresh?
They're painted fresh. Most of them are very antiquated and, frankly, not designed to carry something as volatile and explosive as this stuff. And these were the DOT 111 is the specific tanker type that was involved in the Lac-Mégantic, Quebec explosion that killed 47 people, blew up 40 buildings, destroyed much of a downtown of this little quaint little town in Canada. We had one that went over, and that was in these rails, these tankers in Lynchburg were actually the improved ones that had a bit more added protection on the ends, and they were less likely to have their valves pop open if they were to derail, which is good, but it didn't stop this from happening because it was pierced in the side. So we're looking for stronger regulations from the federal level. The U.S. Department of Transportation is doing this now. We've submitted comments, as many other organizations that are interested about involved in this and have the same concerns as us all over the country have also submitted comments to ensure that the tankers are thicker and more resilient, can take this, take an explosion or prevent this kind of explosion. We think that this can be fixed. We think that We believe that there are safeguards that can be taken, but that they're not being taken.
13 minutes after the hour with Rob Campbell and Pat Calvert. So aside from the from the tankers, from the trains, is that the issue where we need to have new trains? We need to use different metals to build these tankers. We need to have new federal regulations about the speeds that they can go, or put them on different rail lines, et cetera, maybe not so near the rivers. Is that really what it comes down to?
I think that there are, we need to be aware of where they're going. Right now, I don't know, and you don't know, unless you know something that I don't know, what is coming through that's hazardous on these rails, because we're not allowed to know that information. We don't have a, quote, need to know basis with CSX or Norfolk Southern, who are the biggest carriers.
Somebody might go out there and intentionally cause a problem if you know which ones are which.
Sure. So, and the Homeland Security, as well as proprietary information, have been the standard sort of fallbacks on that. However, if I want to go and just look at the rails, I can see a great big placard on every one of those hazardous carrying tankers that says exactly what classification it is, and one can infer exactly what is in it. It does not take a rocket scientist to do that. So that argument has been played down. I'm not asking that we have a detailed list of or schedule as to when these tankers are coming through, but we need to know maybe by a monthly basis what's coming through, what chemicals, and in what amounts, and where. We don't necessarily, we're not demanding to be told when, but I think that communities have the right to know what sort of hazardous materials are being carried, particularly in downtown Richmond, dangling over traffic, over government buildings, schools, hospitals, you name it.
11:15 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, Pat Calvert and Rob Campbell from the James River Association, as we talk about toxic materials and their storage and transportation. Pat, you were going to...
Yeah, I'm sorry. So part of it is the materials that you were speaking of and sort of the integrity and strength of the tankers themselves. Part of it is the amount of inspections. Basically reclassifying Bakken crude oil.
When you talk about inspection, are you talking about inspection of the materials themselves? You're talking about inspecting Bakken so that we know...
Rail safety.
Right, inspecting the rails.
Right.
Okay.
So we have a fairly disjointed, unclear rail inspection record. And there was an article that came out last year, an investigative journalist with the Daily Press in Eastern Virginia, Dave Ress, actually found a significant number of defects on CSX rails, according to the Federal Railroad Administration. So you've got some state authorities, the State Corporation Commission, doing some inspections. You've got the railroad companies themselves doing their own inspections. And they had up to, apparently there was a defect. We don't know the details of it because it's still under review by the National Transportation Safety Board, the derailment in Lynchburg. But there was a defect found in those rails 24 hours prior to that derailment.
All right. There's lots more to talk about here. The phone lines, we'll open up the phone lines when we come back. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Mallory's here to take your call. We shall be right back.
Support today for WNRN comes from
the Jefferson Theater, presenting Zoso, the ultimate Led Zeppelin experience with special guest Cheap Whiskey on Thursday, February 12th. Tickets for the embodiment of Page, Plant, Bonham, and Jones with Zoso on the 12th can be purchased at jeffersontheater.com. Zoso, the ultimate Led Zeppelin experience, Thursday night at the Jefferson Theater.
Ragged Valley Mountain. Subaru, Stanton's employee-owned Subaru dealership. Valley Subaru specializes in all-wheel drive vehicles and has new and used Foresters and Outbacks on the lot. You can browse their current selection with live online support at myvalleysubaru.com.
This is your Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today as we talk about toxic materials. Pat Calvert here, Upper James Riverkeeper from the James River Association. We also have Rob Campbell. He's an Upper James Outreach Coordinator with the JRA. And we've been talking about some specific accidents, something that both of these gentlemen saw down in the Lynchburg area. And there's several other accidents that happened. Pat, current standards, we sort of touched on that in little tidbits here. Current standards, some of them from 1975 or from back in the 70s, and how they might not have kept up with how the toxic materials have changed. You talk about Bakken crude oil and how it's a lot more hazardous than just sort of dark, heavy crude oil. What has been done to try and change the regulations and try and get the transportation groups to keep up?
Well, to keep up with what? I guess that's the determination.
Well, to try and... So, is there a way, whether it's through the James River Association and similar groups, to go to CSX and other transportation groups, or to go to the federal government or state governments and say, look, Bakken crude oil, which we now transport, is much different from heavy crude oil, which you were doing back 40 years ago. You can't follow the same regulations that you were doing then because you're not transporting the same stuff now. Who are you going to try and change these regulations, to try and bring them up to date?
Right. So most of this is interstate commerce, rails. So it's a federal issue for the most part. And the U.S. Department of Transportation is considering considering some rulemaking that would potentially really solve all of our problems on this, or near it would, I think, reassure us, provide some reassurances that that our rivers and our communities are not at undue risk. I hope that they make some strong decisions on that. But the rail industry is an interesting situation. Everything comes back to the oil and gas industry, really, these days, it seems, and the conversion, the loss of coal, which these rails have largely carried for years. Well, that was a major form of commerce for the rail industry. Now they're having to adapt, and it's the Wild West and in North Dakota right now. They can't get this fracked oil and gas out of there fast enough. There's so much demand from them that there's no pipelines, so the rails are hungry. They're looking for any way they can get it and get it out. The balance is doing it safely, because it might need to be done more slowly, which is not going to be popular if FedEx is your biggest client. So it's a balancing act, but we can't really play Russian roulette with our communities when this stuff is being carried through major throughways. And you mentioned routing. Routing is important. Is along the James River the best route to be carrying this, if they're going to be carrying it by rail? I mean, I can't tell you that, but it's one of the only few routes that would lead from West Virginia to Yorktown to be placed upon ships to be sent out in barges. So
would you prefer, and when I say you, I'm asking you to be a voice of the James River Association. Is a pipeline better than, better than a train?
Yeah, that's a great question. Is it? I don't know. Have you heard of pipelines having issues as well? Safety issues?
Yes, I have. I believe there was one somewhere in Montana maybe recently.
Right, yeah.
Where there was an accident and the spill was below all the ice.
Right,
and they were having trouble in that, and that river fed their drinking water, I believe.
Are we speaking about the Yellowstone spill recently?
If that's been in the last month, I want to say yes.
Yeah. It's hard to keep track of which spill's going on these days, because they're becoming sort of commonplace. Which is safer, carrying this stuff by rail, these toxic substances, gases, liquids, or putting them in pipelines? Well, you tell me. If it's safe, it's safe. If it's not, it's not. I don't think comparing them is necessarily going to change anything. I don't think I'll have a hard time finding proponents from one industry saying, well, you don't like pipelines blowing up, why don't you support the rail carrying of it, and vice versa? But there are strong arguments suggesting that that's really a baloney argument. Show me safe. Is it safe or is it not safe? And then let's go from there. I'm not telling you that either one is safe right now. In fact, I would contend that neither are as safe as they should be.
Well, so I think that it is safe to say that the hazardous toxic material is not going away.
Well, it's up to us. The General Assembly is in session right now, and if people want to get involved, I mean, there are some key bills that have made it out of Senate right now that people can voice to their legislators, their elected officials.
Now, are we in Virginia or are we in federal government?
We're in Virginia right okay. now. The federal government, most of those comment periods have passed, and we've had resounding response from the public. We're able to let individuals know based on their zip code which officials they need to contact and when. And if people want to get involved in that, all they have to do is go to riveratrisk.org, register their information. We won't sell it. We won't share it. We will just contact you in a timely fashion with specific instructions on what to do to make sure your river, your waters, your communities are safe from toxics.
All right. So in a shorter time period, with toxic materials still being transported and stored, because again, you mentioned the Dan River incident, and we'll get back to that, and the incident in West Virginia, and we'll touch on that again. Those are storage incidents, not transportation.
Right.
What can be done? Are we just talking about building different style tankers, building different style storage units out of different materials to make these safer units to keep them from the James River, to keep them from our drinking water?
Maybe. How about inspections? Just at the very basis.
Okay, talk about inspections.
Okay,
where do we stand now with the frequency? Because my understanding is that's a big part of the problem. There's an issue with how frequent the inspections take place on the railroads, or infrequent. Right. And along with the frequency of any of this, anything that's related to a toxic material is being inspected rather infrequently.
So for example, the MCHM, the chemical that leaked in Elk River, the tanks that were holding that had not been inspected in 20 years. To us, that's a little extensive for
now,
something.
Is that due to, is that following the law? And the law, or because in some of these cases, my understanding is that things just fall outside of the law.
Right.
There's a law for one and a law for two, but there's no law for three.
So the storage of the majority of chemicals in Virginia is not covered by any regulatory program. None. Some are, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act and the, I have to read this, Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Acts do cover particular above-ground tank storage, but no program covers non-petroleum chemicals or aims to prevent spills and accidents.
So break that down in a little more class
okay.
101.
Certain chemicals, particularly petroleum, based oil-based gasoline stored above ground are pretty well managed. Gasoline tanks at gas stations that are buried are managed pretty well and pretty closely. If you've got any rails around you, any large industries, and you see these great big circular tanks, usually circular cylindrical tanks, they're not necessarily labeled, inspected, much of anything. And so right now, West Virginia closed up many of those loopholes, those gaps. I would say they're not really loopholes. They're just gaps. They're just – we haven't considered the safety of the storage of this stuff. And it got there somehow. So it's probably intrinsically connected to the rail and trucking industries as well. So just making certain that that we know what's in those and that the bucket that's holding it is not got a hole in it. There were significant holes in the one in West Virginia, and there was breakdown of mechanisms that should have alerted the company to know that it was leaking. Those all failed. Everything failed.
But those are expenses. That requires money to be spent.
Indeed. Money that probably should have been well spent. And that's part of, I guess, what our suggestion is that should be the cost of doing business if you're going to deal with anhydrous ammonia, chlorine gas, or various other chemicals that could be devastating to a community or its drinking water source. I think all of these issues that we've brought up, including coal ash, rail transport, and storage, there are ways to safely manage these we just have to create the political will to do so.
Again, our guest today, Pat Calvert, Rob Campbell from the James River Association. We're talking about the storage and transportation of toxic materials, both of them from the James River Association. I see the phone ringing. I don't know if Mallory got that or not, or if we failed to turn the phone off from weekend and automatic voicemail or not. So try. 434-979-0919. So we're talking about the need for greater inspection and more frequent inspection, because I don't know if I got this from you or in my research, but Virginia's rail inspectors are only surveying the tracks along the James once every 30 days. Federal inspectors only investigate 1% yearly of the rails that they regulate. What would be an acceptable amount?
Right, and we asked this question of the State Corporation Commission. We asked this question of CSX directly. And I'm not going to tell you that we got a direct, clear answer, because many of these rail companies are doing their own inspections, and probably far more often than any of the other regulatory agencies. Are they speaking to one another, and is the response time appropriate? So, like I said, there was a defect found in Lynchburg on those tracks 24 hours in advance, and they were still, after days of heavy rain, right along the banks of the river there, a flooded, not a full flood, but a swollen river for sure. They were still carrying this highly dangerous cargo right through there, and we're still waiting on what the NTSB might say, but we're open to suggestion on what is appropriate, but we don't believe that knowing that there was a problem there and having 30 days to fix it and then still carrying this cargo, that just doesn't jive with us. So we're open to understanding what is reasonable for the industry to do, but if safety was compromised, which appears to be, in because there are multiple of these derailments of this toxic substance throughout the country, Alabama, North Dakota, certainly the one in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, we were very fortunate that no one was killed. I, for one, thought that somebody would have certainly perished in the explosion that happened on the James, but it didn't. We dodged a bullet on that. Now, when's the next bullet coming? Because it's somewhat of a time bomb.
Take a few seconds and tell folks about, now mentioned the Quebec story a couple times. Tell folks about that.
Well, I think that people recognize that one because it sort of devastated a town quickly. I don't remember the date right offhand, but there was a massive explosion. A derailment resulted in 47 cars rolling down a hill. All of those tankers were loaded with Bakken crude oil and exploded in the center of a small, quaint, cute little town known as Lac-Mégantic in Quebec. Had it happened during the middle of the day, I'm sure it would have been a far larger number of fatalities. But in this case, it was nighttime, and so there were some businesses open, bars, restaurants, and they were certainly impacted by this, and that resulted in 47 people dying, I believe.
I just find that to be so amazing. I know there's somebody trying to call. We're trying to switch it to, we don't have the secret code to switch it so it doesn't go automatically to voicemail. Give us a few seconds. I'll alert you when we make that secret switch. They don't give everybody here the secret passwords to everything. So we've been hearing from Pat Calvert, Upper James River Keeper from the James River Association, as we talk about storage and transportation of the toxic materials around the North America. Rob Campbell's also here, Upper James Outreach Coordinator. We'll be talking about a new campaign, the Our River at Risk campaign, a little bit later, just a few minutes from now, 11:34 here on the Wake Up Call.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
High Peak Sportswear, the official embroiderer for WNRN apparel. High Peak Sportswear also provides custom screen printing and promotional products for the Lynchburg and Charlottesville areas. High Peak Sportswear can consult and design your projects from fundraiser t-shirts to complete branding packages. You can look them up at hipeak.com.
Croze Pizza at the Buddhist Biker Bar on the UVA corner. It's Croze's pie for carryout or dine-in with parking on Elliewood Avenue. There's live music with Coda Curl's Songwriter Chorale on February 10th and Caitlin Lane on the 11th, plus live DJs every Thursday. You can find the original Croze Pizza in Croze with expanded dining room.
Hello, I'm Catherine Bazzoni from UVA's School of Continuing and Professional Studies. Our personal enrichment program offers evening non-credit courses with no grades and no tests. Course topics include the arts, astronomy, history, gardening, writing workshops, and wellness, among others. Classes meet just one night a week for 4 to 8 weeks. Registration for spring courses is open now. More information about UVA's personal enrichment program is available online at scps.virginia.edu/no grades. I'm Catherine Bazzoni, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And we're back in action, 11:36 here on the wake-up call, talking about toxic materials, storage, transportation. Pat Calvert with us, Rob Campbell with us, and phone line fixed, no longer directly to voicemail. Whoever's been trying so hard, try again, please, 434-979-0919. Hopefully you didn't wear out a finger with all those many attempts. 434-979-0919. So we're talking about the Quebec incident. Again, another train transportation. And then there are the storage. You talked briefly about the Dan River and the coal ash down there and the incident in West Virginia. Do these all tie together? I mean, does the James River Association stand up and wave the flag about these incidents all in one manner? I mean, can you do this all about the same topic?
Yeah, I think that's where they all happened. Sort of, we had the West Virginia, the Dan River, and the derailment explosion in Lynchburg, all within a relatively short amount of time. And so we realized we can't really just pick one out and keep it separate from the others. We decided to create our River at Risk campaign, which in earnest started off in November of 2014. And we'll probably be working on this for the next couple of years to make certain that safeguards are in place, that we don't have a Dan River spill of coal ash. And by the way, Dan River is not the only one that's had significant amounts of coal ash spilt. Kingston, Tennessee was a massive, massive catastrophe where coal ash washed away people's homes, essentially, in 2008. What we want to do is ensure that those things don't happen here. We've got good lessons, and what's important is that we act on those, that we don't just wait and kind of hope that doesn't happen to our drinking water source or America's founding river, the James. So Governor McAuliffe has started this rail safety task force. Senator Warner has been relatively supportive of it, but we need people to speak for the adoption of new rail safety standards for speed limits, insurance, classification of crude oil and transparency, and better tank cars that are made to carry this stuff if it's deemed necessary to carry Bakken crude oil by rail. As far as the storage of these toxins in these big tanks, I think it could be minimized significantly if we just had a safe chemical storage tank construction, inspection, labeling. Many of these aren't labeled at all. Leak detection and record keeping. These just don't exist. West Virginia has far stronger laws than us, but we know what led to their adopting those regulations. We need to sort of – we have an opportunity here to make certain that that doesn't happen. And like I said, there are some bills in General Assembly right now that have so far – all of them have passed the Senate and are going to be introduced to the House of Delegates, which is encouraging.
Well, the Dan River incident – with the coal ash, the Dan River, that was actually on the North Carolina side of the border, correct?
It was.
So what happens if Virginia, you know, makes these stronger laws and guidelines, but the incident takes place in another state? Does that mean anything?
Well, EPA came out just recently with a new rule that would apply to all existing coal ash storage plants. And just so you know, coal ash is basically treated like household garbage. No more strict, although it contains boron, selenium, mercury, arsenic, a whole host of stuff you don't want to.
Yeah, you don't sprinkle that on your cereal.
You don't want that on your cereal or anywhere else. So, and we have these around. I don't think people are necessarily aware that they're around, but we've got over 5 billion gallons of this stuff sitting on the banks of the James. Most of them are all owned by one company. And we have approached that company about what are their plans to manage it safely. And so we're working with the industry. We hope that they'll adopt some of the things that have happened in North Carolina. But North Carolina underwent they actually have more strict regulations than the EPA placed upon them a little bit. So frankly, it's still treated as a non-hazardous waste. According to the EPA. So the state of Virginia has an opportunity here to treat the stuff, this nasty stuff, more appropriately to make certain that it's not leaking. There are currently significant lawsuits pending with coal ash storage ponds in Virginia. None of them are in actually one of them is in the James River watershed, I believe, far downstream. But we have our concerns. We're looking at these particular large and small, sometimes off the radar, coal ash ponds that are sitting around. In many cases, in every case in North Carolina, every one was found to be contaminating groundwater.
But you just did I not hear you correctly when you said that North Carolina had laws stronger than the EPA?
Right, and just because they predated the EPA's rulemaking because they were being responsive to the Dan River coal ash spill. It was sort of a reactive way of managing an issue, and what we have here is an opportunity, I believe, to not be so reactive but to be proactive to prevent millions of gallons of this stuff ending up in our water. According to Duke Energy, the Dan River's cleaned up, but 90% of that coal ash is still sitting on the bottom of that river. I don't know how I would feel if I knew my drinking water was coming from that river downstream across the straight lines in Danville.
Again, that's Pat Calvert from the James River Association. Upper James River Keeper. Hey, Mallory, come in here for a second, because I want to make sure that we read this question properly, and I'm going to ask you to read it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, Mallory Kidwell, come on around. Just read this into the microphone for me. Caller called in with this question, and after all the trouble she had getting through.
She had more of a comment to make, and I guess to hear your opinions on her comment. But she was saying that it was less the trains that were the unsafe part of why we're having these spills and accidents, more so that it was the tracks that were unsafe. Apparently, they replaced the wooden cross tiles on the tracks with concrete ones. And so she was saying that those were less stable and then had to be replaced again by wooden. So if there's a comment on that, on whether you believe that it's more the trains or the tracks or what your opinions are.
I would agree with her that, you know, infrastructure is huge, and we've got failed infrastructure, and that's part of what this is about. Our rail infrastructure is in bad shape, and we all benefit from the rail industry in many shapes and forms every day. Everything around you is probably sitting on a train nearly at some point. But the DOT 111, I have to take issue with that and say that it might – you know, infrastructure is a major part of it, but the DOT 111, if she does some research, you'll see that the U.S. Department of Transportation itself for decades has been saying that these tankers are antiquated and unsafe. Themselves have been saying that they are antiquated and unsafe. So that's, you know, I would suggest that it is the tankers themselves. Absolutely. That is a part of it. There's strong evidence out there that would show that even the government believes that. But there's been resistance to change out of those because they're cheap and they're available, and it's going to cost a lot of money to get safer tankers. There's no doubt. We're not suggesting this should happen overnight, but it should be phased in a relatively meaningful period of time. I don't think a decade is reasonable. I think it would need to be a shorter amount of time than that, but there should already be motion to improve the safety of those tankers. Because they are at fault.
Okay, thanks with the call and the comment. Pat, quick follow-up to that is, do you think that this is going to be a environmentalist versus business battle? You're ruining jobs when you ask this is to be done, and you're going to crush businesses by asking this to be done in such a fast period of time.
Well, I don't know that I'm not suggesting exactly what that time period would be.
If it's less than a decade, that's a lot of expense, et cetera,
Sure. That discussion has to happen. Right now, we're not really having that discussion. It's just treat it as if it's not a problem and wait for the next derailment, which will happen.
To wait until it happens in some important person's front yard.
Yeah, I hate to say that, but you said it, so not me.
If it had happened elsewhere in West Virginia, it might have taken a lot longer for that legislation to pass. But because it happened where it did, when it did, that legislation passed quite quickly.
Many of the spills of Bakken crude and train derailments have occurred in the middle of nowhere, and that's why they didn't get much media play. I don't think many people know about the big spill in Alabama last year. Not many at all, because it was in the middle of a wetland in a very remote area. Several of the national correspondents who came to Lynchburg said, you know, I hate to say that this is good that it happened here, but it's good that it happened here because there was response, and it was clear that this could have significantly impacted that the community of Lynchburg. We've got these going right through Richmond in mass. I've got pictures from one that went through 2 days ago from our lower James River Keeper that was just sitting still right over traffic, right in the heart of Richmond. So it's not just about water and the environment. It's also about the safety of our communities.
Let's take this call. Kirk, are you with us? Kirk?
Call back, right. Kirk.
Earth to Kirk.
that's probably me, but you never know. Obviously, I'm not on my game with the phone today. 434-979-0919, talking about toxic materials, but with gentlemen from the James River Association. And not everybody knows that that's about more than just the toxic materials. And so Rob Campbell's come up and been sitting there so quietly and waiting and
waiting, I'm allowed
and waiting his turn. And so,
well, those are important.
Take your time while we wait for me to cut Kirk off again.
Poor Kirk.
I know. Do your thing.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, regardless of some of the problems that the James River faces, it still is absolutely a wonderful place to recreate and enjoy and spend your time in the summer months and even all times of the year. So just to update everybody in the upper watershed, the great events that we have going on the James River this summer. The first of those being our James River Rundown. Last year was our first time that we held this event. It's a 100-mile paddle race from James River State Park to Robius Landing in Richmond. Very exciting event. Last year was incredible how fast some of those racers got down. I think the winners were 17 hours mm-hmm. that paddled 100 miles, which is incredibly impressive. So a great event, a good way to test your grit out on the James River.
All right, let me take this. Let me try.
Kirk's back. Thanks,
call
Kirk.
Call from Kirk. And Kirk?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. You have a question or a comment?
I have a comment. I am a state chair for the Sierra Club. In my travels, I've come across an impending disaster, I think. It's pretty serious with dealing with coal ash deposits. There's a coal ash deposit area in Giles County, which is near to the New River. And there's a lot of concern down in that area that one good flood could carry the coal ash into the river. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. There's some other areas that are in jeopardy. Time.
Yeah, they're all over the state, that's for sure. You don't have to go that far. I mean, from the studios where we are right now, Fluvanna County is not far away, and on the banks of the BREMO facility run by Dominion Power, there's several million gallons of toxic coal ash sitting right beside the river in several ponds. You go downstream, Chesterfield has an even larger one. So our interest is to make certain that that stuff is stored properly, because right now it's sitting in antiquated ponds that aren't lined. And there's, you know, everyone in North Carolina that was found in an unlined pond was found to be leaking. So that's,
yes,
yeah, that's of concern.
Well, right. I applaud your efforts. Thank you so much for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kirk.
Bye.
When you say unlined pond, I have this vision of somebody with their backhoe digging a deep hole and then filling it with coal ash instead of putting down some, you know, like black liner that you might do if you were putting a goldfish pond in your front yard.
And you wouldn't be far from the truth.
Oh, all right. Phone line is open if you want to call 434-979-0919. That's Pat Calvert from James River Association talking about toxic materials and storage and transportation. Along the James, we finally let Rob Calvert, Rob Campbell, have a brief say about what the James River Association does, aside from comment about toxic materials. And so, aside from, and you were talking about this, 100-mile paddle,
100-mile paddle race. It really is a great event.
When that's coming up this year?
It's coming up this year on June 27th and 28th. It's going to take 2 days for most of our racers to get there. Even our winning paddlers last year did in 17 hours, so they had to take a little break there in the evening time. But
can I have an electric motor?
No electric motors. If you do want to paddle at night, you got to have lights and stuff like that.
Can I have a case of Red Bull?
That can, yeah, you're willing to carry that stuff. It's up to you if you want to carry the weight. So, but it really is an exciting paddle. I mean, it's incredible. We've got a couple good stops on the way if paddlers need to take a break and rest their heads. So really, really interesting stuff. And you can find the information on that at jamesriverrundown.org. So, and that's part of our James River Association webpage. We also have another exciting event that's a little bit less of endurance oriented, but still on that same note, and that's the Richmond and Lynchburg James River Splash and Dash. That's a short, the one in Richmond is a 5K. It's a short run followed by a short float in the river and kind of a paddle through the river on tubes in downtown Richmond, and they come back to the banks and finish the race. Lynchburg is very similar. We race down Percival's Island right in the middle of the James River. It's a beautiful trail going right through the heart of the river there, and we come back and do our own short section on tubes in the James River, and we come back to shore to finish the race.
Hey, how does the James River Association feel about the businesses that do the tubing down the James? Because in the Charlottesville, Albemarle, Central Virginia area, you know, that's something that you do during the summer. You go down to the two or three places in our area and you go tubing. And there's, you know, all the signs about don't bring glass bottles, don't throw your trash in the river, but there's always the jerks who do that anyway.
That's right.
And so what does the James River Association do to help people act more like adults and to help the businesses be the best business that they can in using the James?
Sure, absolutely. And I think a lot of the, speaking from experience from working at Outfitter previously and knowing a lot of the guys that run Outfitter companies up and down the James, they do an impeccable job at educating their customers on what is the proper uses of the river, and especially in regards to discarding refuse that they have. Now, of course, you've got those guys that once they get off the bank, they're going to do what they're going to do, and you're not there to hold their hand. But we really hope and throughout the past, groups have held themselves accountable. When they go out and see such a serene, pretty place, a lot of people want to make sure it stays that way. And really, it is a lot about education. It's a lot about getting that through to people that once you see a pristine area, you know, what better to do than keep it that way? So it's all about education.
I think Pat called the James River the
America's Founding River.
America's Founding Absolutely. River. Thank you. Explain that.
Sure. And that's a great segue. I will explain in a couple of different ways. So that was really the first colony from the Western civilizations in Europe as it came over was in Jamestown. One of the first, of course, was one on Roanoke Island as well. But that's right at the mouth of the James River where it enters the Chesapeake Bay. So all the westward expansion into the newly found territories was up the James River and other tributaries of the Chesapeake Bay as well. But the James was a very primary source for a lot of that westward expansion and exploration up the river. So from its history at Jamestown to all the history, of course, our state capital sits right there on the river, and it has in several locations at Williamsburg and, of course, at Richmond. So just steeped in Virginia and national history. Of course, the Cornwallis was defeated right there, of course, down there at Yorktown. So it's a very, very historic asset and really can hearken all the way back to the very beginnings of American history.
And just a few minutes left, 11:56 here on the Wake Up Call as we're talking with Rob Campbell and Pat Calvert from the James River Association. We touched on it once or twice, but a few minutes to finish up with the Our River at Risk campaign and what's happening with James River Association, and tell people about that.
Sure. Our River at Risk. And if you just go to riveratrisk, all one word, .org, right now, if you're sitting near a computer, write it down. If you're driving, please don't do that. But we will basically just collect very basic
information. You can get it on the podcast.
There you go.
We'll put it on the SeavillePodcast.com or WNRN.org. You'll get the podcast. We'll put the link in there.
Beautiful. Thank you, Rick. We'll collect basic information from you, and we will notify you. We will not start spamming you and sending you hourly updates, but we will let you know where your voice can best be heard and to whom and about what regarding all these issues, coal ash, toxic transport, and storage.
And the current focus, I mean, because so – right now, if I sign up today, what am I going to get? You know, what is the focus now in February and March?
With the General Assembly in session for a little bit longer, we've got some particular bills that, like I said, have passed Senate and now will enter the House. One is the Water Protection and Toxic Chemicals Advisory Committee, and which would establish report with sunset provisions on this toxic materials. One is the toxic waste sites inventory by the Department of Environmental Quality, and that one has been approved contingent upon a companion budget amendment. That's SB 771. SB 811 was the prior one, and then we've got penalties from the Department of Environmental Quality. They're kind of minimal right now. You can get slapped on the wrist and consider a wrist, and that can just be sort of a not much for a large business.
You know, that leads me to this. We got like 60 seconds left.
Sure.
So the accident that happened down at the James in Lynchburg, the train track wreck. We talked about oil burning on the river.
Right.
Was there a penalty given?
Yeah, there is a notice of violation from the Department of Environmental Quality. It is still being negotiated between CSX and the Department of Environmental Quality. We've been involved at an average of $17 per gallon of for a fine. That's the state average, 30,000 gallons. We're talking about $500,000 would be a foreseeable cost to them.
For a fine for CSX?
Right, yeah.
Would that be the expected only fine given?
I realize
yes. You can't say this is definite, but I'm asking you, is that what's expected to happen?
Potentially, yeah.
How much money has it cost, or how much money has already been spent by the state and therefore by the people to clean this up and get to where it is?
Don't know the number on that, but it's a significant amount. That's part of the insurance concern as well. When in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, when that happened, that terrible tragedy, overnight that company went into bankruptcy. And so now the taxpayers are having to fix it all.
Oh, Pat Calvert, Upper James River Keeper, Rob Campbell, Upper James Outreach Coordinator from the James River Association. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks, Rick.
Today. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Next Sunday, we'll be talking about poverty. There's a local group putting together a simulation on the challenges of living in poverty. And next up, Les Temps Purdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.